back to the Missing Maura Murray podcast. Lance, how are you tonight?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you?
Doing great. This interview is very fun. I think for us personally, we got to open up a little bit and we got to talk to two very smart, brilliant, I dare say, professors from across the pond.
Yes, two professors of criminology. They listen to the podcast. They are extremely interested in the case. They have their classes study elements of the case and elements of other unsolved crimes.
Professor David Wilson and Professor Elizabeth Yardley are going to join us in just a little bit for a chat about secondary victims of homicide in newer media, an article that they wrote and published recently. Check the show notes for some links to information about that, although I don't believe their paper is actually viewable online, but we do get into it a little bit.
Yeah, their paper is titled, To Me, It's Real Life. And it's on the surface, it seems like it would be a pretty challenging read. It's about 30 pages, probably about 28 pages once you get past the notes and the references. Once you start reading it, it really feels familiar and almost like a instruction manual for those who contribute to true crime online. What I mean is it shows you the cause and effect and the effect and the reaction of what people say and how it comes back to people who are close to that particular case.
We cover a broad range of topics, including our relationship to the Murray family, the ethics of doing a podcast like this, armchair detectives in general, people injecting themselves into this story and other stories, missing white woman syndrome, which is very interesting, and of course their personal theories at the end of the episode.
Yeah, and the thing that really struck me was as I was reading it, so many things about it, so many elements of this paper were so familiar and so applicable to what we're doing, and I didn't realize it was going to be, you know, when we first asked them if they wanted to be on, they sent us the paper. I was a little nervous about what we were going to talk about and how it was going to be relevant to this case. But once I read it and once you hear the interview, you realize it's extremely relevant to this case and it's relevant to all unsolved crime. It's relevant to all online crime. And you really understand, and I think it's important with this case and with anybody who contributes to perhaps solving a mystery and using the online platform to do so, it's really, you really should think about who you are, like where, what you're doing and what category you fit into. Because you fit into a category that's brand new. They bring up the new media aspect. Newer media aspect of everything. And you realize what movement you're a part of. And it's a brand new movement, and it's a really revolutionary movement, and it's not anything that's going to go away because, I mean, the internet's not going to go away. And people's interest, their fascination in true crime is not going to go away. And I think it's really important to understand what your roots are and what your foundation is, and you're a part of something that is that's new in the landscape of this whole platform.
Okay, but before we roll that very interesting interview, we want to mention the UMass Outing Club, the track cabin in Bethlehem, New Hampshire, in the White Mountains, that was in the news recently because 12 UMass athletes, students, went to Bethlehem, and one of them had a bad reaction to LSD. So they basically all got in trouble because they tried to get this one person help. And it is a little bit of insight into what goes on at this cabin. But more than that, it sort of sparked a lot of debate online recently.
Yeah, it did. And there's been a lot of behind-the-scenes activity going on for a while now involving this cabin. And it's it hasn't reached nearly the level of, say, the red truck or the rag in the tailpipe or, you know, Rick Forcier's sighting of what could be Maura. Those are all the very apparent elements of our discussions when we're talking about the case. This has always kind of been on the peripheral of those discussions. I don't think we've ever mentioned it on air other than maybe fielding some questions on it. I don't remember having any really in-depth conversations about it. And there's a reason for that. And we're going to get into that reason momentarily.
While the idea of this UMass cabin is new to a lot of people online, this is actually something that we knew about months ago. And John Smith actually knew about it back in 2004. So this is something that was investigated in the past. And furthermore, we actually asked law enforcement a question about this.
So the question was, and it was the 41st question that we asked them, this question relates to an outing club owned by UMass that's located in Bethlehem, New Hampshire. Has there ever been any indication that this may have been Mora's ultimate destination?
Their answer is, no information slash evidence collected indicates that she was headed for Bethlehem or for an outing club. We did have a conversation that resulted in us agreeing to omit this question. And I think the reason was, and help me if I'm wrong here, Lance, was more because we were afraid that the online community was really going to, I don't know if act on this is the right word, but really let this one get away with them. Because ultimately, the police's answer is that there was no evidence or information collected that indicates. So they don't think that Mora was headed there at this time. So that means nothing in her car, nothing that anybody said to them would suggest that there was anything going on at that cabin this night. So you can run with that if you want, but keep in mind that the authorities are not looking at it right now.
And we know how our listeners and how people involved in this case from a distance will feverishly and passionately look into different elements of the case. And we're not saying that we believe that she was or was not going to this cabin. We're just saying it's such a...
It could be possible that she was headed there. I don't think we want to say that it's not. We looked at this and you can look at the map yourself and it could be possible that she was heading there, but the fact still remains that there is no evidence to suggest that that was the case.
And Tim and I try to approach everything with the understanding that what we put out there could possibly have an effect on the case. So I feel like this was one of the questions that we rolled around for a little while and we decided, hey, the way it was answered, we didn't want to put it out there and have any part of the investigation be compromised in any way by any false information that might come forward. We wanted to wait for the right time. We've seen things about this case and we've seen instances come forward and theories come forward and what could possibly be a break come forward. And it's turned out that it hasn't been accurate. And in the meantime, people who are involved with whatever piece of information came forward that might have been a break, they're now involved in this case, and it really affects their lives. So Tim and I always try to approach this we try to be as responsible as possible. And if there is something that is answered by law enforcement where, you know, we finally got law enforcement to answer some questions, their answers we want to make sure we put out there in the most responsible way possible. So this was one of those questions that we thought, hey, this might be something that they have more information on. This is a plausible theory as to her destination. And if they don't have any information, they don't have any evidence that was collected, something about that strikes me as maybe they're still looking into it and they're still collecting information. Where they're still collecting evidence. And it's something that we didn't want to compromise the investigation by giving an answer and having people run with it.
And also the problem with it is that you can take it a bunch of different ways too. It doesn't rule out anything. It doesn't, you know, you can look at it and say, oh, well, that means she didn't get there. And that means she was probably abducted. Or that means, she had a destination that night. That means one of her friends picked her up and they went there and partied that night. Well, we can't tell you yes or no to either of those. All we can tell you is what the police said, law enforcement said. No information / evidence collected indicates that she was headed for Bethlehem or for an outing club.
Don't take this information and start contacting people on your own.
Or just being convinced of it as being the truth.
Right.
Take it for what it is.
It's pretty relevant right now going into this interview that we did with the professors of criminology. A random occurrence happened where a UMass student had a bad reaction to LSD. Therefore, that becomes something relevant with this case because it's UMass and it was a cabin in that area. So obviously, you know, 1 + 1 = Maura was headed there and she told friends and they were all going to party there. But if law enforcement tells us that's not the case, it's frustrating, but we might have to just say, okay, well, yeah, it would have been a really convenient connect the dots moment, but it probably isn't because law enforcement has told us that it's not.
And they found no evidence of her being there.
Right. This shows you how that new media element, that newer media element, and that the armchair detective culture, you need to be a little, you have to be more selective. Vet it, you know, vet it out and make sure that it's not a lead or it is a lead. But don't come out and assume that you have the authority to determine something that law enforcement has dismissed because it's new to you.
Okay, well said, Lance. And let's roll the interview with Professor David Wilson and Professor Elizabeth Yardley. Welcome to the podcast, Professor David Wilson and Professor Elizabeth Yardley, professors of criminology from the UK. How are you doing this Friday night?
Well, I'm very well. And even though it's 8:30 and there's rugby on the television, I'm excited to be talking to you. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, me too. It makes sure that I'm not making dinner. I get to put that off for a little bit longer. So that's good.
We'll try to make it as interesting as possible for you. Again, thank you for coming on. And we'll, I don't know, you can maybe DVR the rugby game match. Is it a match?
It's a match. It's live paused at the moment. It's Harlequins, who are based in London, playing against Montpellier, a French side. But I've live paused it because this is far more important.
Okay. I think I have money on the Harlequins. So go Harlequins.
Well, welcome to the show. We wanted to have you on. You guys wrote a paper, a very interesting article. It's called "To Me, It's Real Life: Secondary Victims of Homicide in Newer Media," and it is about the Reddit page from the Serial case, the Heyman Lee case, of course, the one that Serial covered on season one, and it's about the brother of, well, actually, you guys tell us what it's about. I wouldn't do it justice.
Yeah, sure. Well, basically, we were really interested in Serial, weren't we? So we were kind of following the podcast and following what was happening around the podcast online, and we came across the Serial subreddit. And I'm quite interested in Reddit, and I follow quite a few different subreddits, various different things. And I noticed the Serial subreddit kind of pop up, and there was an awful lot of activity on there. So I just started seeing what were people saying on there, what kind of things were they talking about. And it soon became quite obvious that it wasn't just kind of fans of the podcast that were on there discussing it. There were also people who were or claimed to be connected to the case itself. So I thought that was a really interesting concept. So you've got these kind of fans of infotainment, you know, this idea that true crime can also, you know, cross over into the entertainment realm. You've got them coming into the same environment as people who've been personally affected by the homicide that true crime representation, you know, is part of. And I thought I just want to kind of have a bit more of a look at this and see what's going on.
And I think for me, Elizabeth has kind of prompted me to start looking more closely at social media and how social media is changing the entire context in which crime can be investigated, crime can be announced, crime can be committed. And it was that sense of moving into living in media as opposed to living with media that began to intrigue both of us. And so it was based, the materials that we wrote, about Serial, To Me It's Real Life, were based on earlier research that Elizabeth and I had conducted about Facebook murder. We were intrigued by how murderers were using Facebook. And it was that journey from Facebook murder into thinking about podcasting and Serial that really led us both into your incredible podcast about missing Maura Murray.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, and that's really interesting. Your journey to find to write this paper, and it is a fascinating subject, and very well. It made me feel smarter just reading it. Just holding it makes me feel smarter.
That's very kind of you to say so. Thank you.
No, and I just wanted to say thank you for bringing this to us. I'm not going to lie. When I printed it up and saw the 33 pages, I was I started to sweat a little bit. I was a little daunted and almost afraid that I was going to start reading it and going, I don't get this at all.
I'm the queen of the lengthy paper, and David will tell you if there's something I can say in two paragraphs that could be summed up in a sentence, I'll say it in two paragraphs.
Yeah, but that's even that is the length. Once I sat down and committed myself to, okay, I'm going to take this time and read this, my brain just like ate it up. I was highlighting stuff. It's really, really, it's really user friendly. It's really relatable, because you have, and you even touch on the that concept. You know, Serial was focusing on late teens, 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds. So the podcast community is in that age range, and they can relate to it. We're doing a podcast about a similar kind of, you know, about a mystery. So it was really relatable to me. And you had a really great line here in right in the beginning. It's something that I highlighted. The difference between something like This American Life and Serial, the podcast, the reason why people, you know, sort of ate it up was because it was a quote here, because a podcast seems like a better place for a long story that you need to hear from the beginning. I thought that was one of the first things that stood out to me, and something that I didn't understand going into doing our podcast about Maura. That it's something, it's a long story, and it's something that people can now reference at different points if they want to know certain facts about it.
And I think are getting much more sophisticated in terms of what they're demanding from media now. So there's a real appetite for those lengthy, complex narratives. People want to understand cases and stories inside out from various different perspectives, talking to various different experts, rather than having a kind of neatly packaged half-hour program or hour program. I think there's a real kind of commitment to really kind of lose themselves in cases now. And we saw that with the Jinx on HBO and other types of thing like that. So people really want to get in and understand, you know, try and get inside the mind of people who are involved in these mysteries.
I think Elizabeth's touching on something that both of us feel very passionately about, because both of us appear regularly on British television talking about crime, and we kept pushing producers and directors and commissioners to say, you know, look, actually, I think a lot of the public understand the answers to the questions that you're posing to us. We want to take you to the next level. And the next level was both about a complexity in relation to the issues that were being presented in black and white. There was a great deal of gray in the issues that were being presented. But also there was a sense, and it seems to me that you guys capture this, that there was an unfolding drama to what was being presented, as opposed to things which were cut and dried and neatly packaged within you know, one episode. And that's why the podcast, it seemed to me, to be such a mechanism to be able to explore different narratives, competing narratives, and allow the public to judge for themselves, as opposed to having a judgment imposed upon them.
And now when anybody asks me why we think that this podcast can have, you know, as many episodes as possible, I'm just going to play that clip. I will never be able to say it like that.
That's so kind. For us, Serial and The Jinx were game changers. Elizabeth and I appear. Elizabeth's doing Born to Kill in the United States. I'm doing Interview with a Murderer for Channel 4 at the moment. And both of us have used the kind of context that you guys have set out to be able to say to producers, directors, look, you've got to take this further. If you are simply presenting this in the way that they present things on, say, something which is completely fictional, like CSI, then you're dumbing it down so much that you're not allowing the audience any agency in relation to how they will interpret what it is, the knowledge that we've got about particular types of crimes.
So how did you guys come across our podcast?
Well, I was a real fan of Serial, and after Serial finished, I was getting kind of Serial withdrawal symptoms. So I was having a look around for something else that really kind of got into an individual case. So I subscribe to other podcasts like Sword and Scale and those types of things, but they just tend to look at one case per episode, and I just wanted to get into something else. And I also needed something to accompany me on the runs that I do, because I'm quite a keen runner. And I don't like running to music. I like running to stories, essentially. So I was having a look around on iTunes. And then I think Crime Writers on Serial, their podcast recommended Maura Murray, and they were talking about the case and your podcast. I thought, I'm going to give that a go. And I went on some incredibly lengthy runs to be able to listen to some of the episodes. So yeah, that's how I got started with it.
And it was Elizabeth that then convinced me that I don't go on lengthy runs, but lengthy walks. And it was Elizabeth that convinced me that there was something here that was interesting. I must say, I was slightly skeptical initially, because I said, oh, is this just part of missing white woman syndrome, that I'm going to hear a story about classically the kinds of stories that will emerge and be given purchase and some kind of platform in traditional media, albeit this is a podcast. But the more I kind of saw the layers that were being built up and the way that I felt that the narrative was unfolding, hooked me in, because I felt you were prepared to take risks throughout the podcast. I mean, for example, I must be asked every single week by a TV producer if I would be prepared to work with a clairvoyant, a sensing murder kind of idea. And I've always said no, because I see that as so repellent. And yet you were prepared to use the podcast to actually have a kind of an alternative voice to see if that could throw some light onto the subject. And I thought you did it incredibly well, even if I distrusted what it was that your clairvoyant was saying to you. And both of you engaged later in a really reflective way about how she might have been able to have said some of the things that she said to you. And I thought that was actually incredibly brave of you both to be able to do so.
Well, thanks a lot. Yeah, it's as we were talking about right before we started rolling, this podcast definitely is now nowhere near where me and Lance expected it to be. In fact, I don't even think we I don't even know what we expected when we first started this. I mean, we're not journalists. We didn't go to journalism school. We know how to tell stories, but we didn't really write it out. We didn't script it out. We did it in real time. Just seeing where it took us and going episode by episode.
And I wonder, Elizabeth and I, when we talk about, when we reflect on what we've listened to, some of the things that we would like to ask of you relate to some of the ethical issues that must have cropped up for you as a consequence of not having gone to journalism school and therefore not understanding necessarily, I don't know if this is true, but not necessarily understanding the libel or the slander laws, which would really constrain a filmmaker in a traditional sense. I wondered what sort of ethical layers that you had put in for yourselves, and if there were some challenges along the way ethically that you felt that you could not overcome and therefore had to drop in terms of what you were prepared to broadcast.
It was a challenge figuring out what we can talk about, what we should or shouldn't talk about, with it being still an open investigation. That's one thing. Also trying to sift through all of the rhetoric, I guess would be the word to use, that comes along with this case, that comes along with the blogs and the commenters and everybody, the Reddits, the Reddit contributors. There's so many theories out there. Tim and I really in the beginning, we still do, and it's more instinctive now, but in the beginning, we probably after the third or fourth episode, we really started making a focused effort to figure out how to deliver information and not pin any one theory down and not properly vet everything. Properly vet everything and everyone and give enough information so the listeners can put the pieces together on their own, and maybe something new can come of that.
That's it's challenging, isn't it, in terms of ethics? And we find that as well in our work, because as academics, if we want to do an official piece of research, it has to go through an ethics committee at the university. And invariably, these committees include people who aren't criminologists. So they're people from different disciplines within our faculty. So they're people from business and they're people from law. And sometimes it's quite difficult to get, approval for the types of things that we do. So it's a real minefield at times, isn't it?
And what interests us both is that, of course, for us, the two greatest social experiments in social psychology were the Stanford Prison Experiment and the Milgram's Obedience to Authority experiments. Mm. So Zimbardo and Milgram, and neither Zimbardo or Milgram would have had ethical approval, and neither of those experiments, if they were being, if they had to go through an ethics committee within the academy today, would ever have been given approval. And so it seems to me very interesting that you're at the cutting edge of trying to work out for yourselves, well, wait a minute, what do we think just on a common sense level here we can say, and those things that actually we shouldn't be saying because this is still an open case. Very, very interesting.
Yeah, it really is. It's that, and as we get into it, we see that we do have a lot of listeners who bring forward very reasonable theories, and we have people who are close to the case communicating to us. And some things do make sense, and some things don't make any sense, but we see that there can be, and maybe we are on the edge of figuring something out, but we see that there can be a way to make this investigation come together with the information that we provide. So it's also like accepting that responsibility.
When we first got involved in starting this, we definitely had no idea about any libel laws or slander laws or anything like that. We didn't really, I feel like we were kind of like chickens with our heads cut off a little bit, like running around just talking. We were just talking and seeing what happened. And then we pretty much started refocusing every maybe group or batch of episodes that we did. And I remember at one point we were really like, maybe we were 7-10 episodes in, I'm not really sure, but we were like, well, how the hell are we still doing this about the Murray family, and we've never even spoken to the Murrays? And it was kind of dawned on us, and I felt really awful about it, actually, because it's like, we've said some some really questionable things. We've put the focus on Fred at times because we went into this blind saying we're going to look at everything. And, well, Fred and the Murray connection we had to look at as well. And that was a really interesting moment. I think that was the point where we said, well, at least we can try to give Fred what he wanted 12 years ago, which was for the FBI to take over this case. And so we worked with John in setting up the petition. We figured we could get several thousand signatures and that could maybe elicit some further involvement from the FBI. And it didn't or hasn't yet, but at least it got a response, which was kind of surreal in general, just reading that.
And yeah. Is that the journey that you guys have been on? Because initially, my interpretation, I won't at all speak for Elizabeth, but my interpretation is that the journey that you've been on is that you were firstly interested in the phenomenon. Why this case? Why this phenomenon? Why this particular girl? And then gradually, as you've gone on that journey, you're not just giving voice to an interest about the case generically, you know, why this case, why does it have purchase, that you've become incredibly and centrally involved in the investigation of her going missing. And that leads into some of the things that Elizabeth and I have been trying to write academically about this phenomenon of the armchair detective. And it seemed to me, would this be fair? I don't want to paint you with this if you think it's wrong, but that you have become the armchair detectives that you were initially interested in simply discussing.
That's absolutely accurate, and it was sort of, I guess, after realizing it, it's strange, and was not intentional, but in looking back, it was inevitable, I guess.
Yeah, it's interesting because as social scientists, there are quite a few criminologists and sociologists who do a particular type of research called ethnography, and that essentially means that they go and hang around with the groups that they study. They spend time with them. They kind of immerse themselves in their lives and their realities. And one of the terms that always pops up in relation to ethnography is going native. And that means basically becoming one of the group that you're studying. And several of our colleagues, I think, have over the years who've done that kind of research have found themselves, you know, on teetering on the edge sometimes and other times, you know, diving right in. And it's difficult to kind of say, this is something I'm investigating and then this is something I'm actually part of. But I think our view in terms of the type of criminology we do is that sometimes you have to be part of it to understand it. You can't stand back and be an objective observer, because in order to access the meanings and the realities, you've got to kind of hang around with people and spend time with them and really kind of get into their environment and their reality.
And that for me is where you have hit this kind of zeitgeist, because it seems to me that traditional law enforcement, criminologists working in universities, really haven't understood how to harness the power of the development of social media. For us, it seems to us, that there is something going on here that is incredibly useful for law enforcement, if only law enforcement really understood how to use it better. And in a sense, therefore, you're at this first wave about how to tell the stories, but then gradually you become part of that community that's trying to investigate. And it's the investigatory power or the investigatory potential that really is something that is incredibly open and for law enforcement to try and pick up upon.
Now, is that an example of the remediation that you write about in your paper?
Yes, I think so. Because when we talk about the idea of remediation, we're saying that there isn't a real stark dividing line between old media and new media, but they shape and they fashion each other. So if you think about newspapers now, it's not just, you know, we've moved from newspapers to something else, but newspapers have got online forms and online comment sections. So we participate in media now rather than just consume it. And I think that's something that the criminologists are still kind of struggling to get their heads around, and the same for law enforcement as well.
I think I'm very comfortable about saying, Lance and Tim, that Elizabeth and I, when we ask our first-year criminology students, and we'll have a 400 students in the lecture theatre in the very first week, we'll ask them to put up their hands if any of them have read a traditional newspaper in the preceding month. And if 5% say, if 5% put up their hands, we're now rather shocked. They will not consume newspapers. They will not buy into news in any of the traditional ways that my generation would consume news. They are now online entirely. And therefore, if you think about that as a phenomenon, we've got to, criminologists, academics, others, they've got to acknowledge that phenomenon and work out, therefore, why would how could they get information to young people about crime, about that they young people might be able to offer information in terms of their knowledge of crimes that have been committed. Well, how does a traditional law enforcement agency access that group of people who can potentially tell them things? And of late, what Elizabeth and I have been very keen to discuss is the future of murder and how the whole context in which murder is going to happen and that murderers and how murderers will behave is absolutely changing as a consequence of people now living in as opposed to living with media.
We need to stop kind of thinking about people who contribute to these types of forums and that kind of thing as just one homogeneous mass. I think we've got lots of different types of people who get involved in Reddit forums and add comments and those types of things. Because I think in the early days of the internet, I think one of the biggest concerns that people had was around anonymity. So people not identifying who they are on particular sites and particular forums. And we've started to see that's kind of shifted and changed a bit, whereas we look at Reddit and people are able to conceal their identities quite well on there. But then when we look at a platform like Facebook, there's not so much of that goes on because we use that in a slightly different way. So when we're on Facebook, we're basically using that to maintain our existing relationships that we have with people face to face. But on forums like Reddit, you know, often these are people who don't know each other offline. So you find that the behaviour is quite different from one to the other.
One of the things that we've been very interested to pursue is how online and offline behaviour might overlap or mirror. And of course, one of the things that criminologists always do is that we love developing typologies. And so you were coming up there with a typology, a classic way, a stereotype about how people online, what they will be like. But when Elizabeth and I, for example, conducted the research about how people were using Facebook in the commission of or after the event of a murder, we found a variety of different ways that people use Facebook. For example, there would be some Facebook murderers who would use Facebook to inform people. They were informers. They wanted to say they had committed the murder, and they wanted to gain the maximum amount of publicity by being able to inform as many people as possible through using Facebook. But equally, we had people who were reactors on Facebook. They would react. They would use the fact that, for example, classically, somebody had changed their status from married to single or in a relationship, and they would react to that change of status. And that was that reaction that prompted them to want to take the life of the person who had changed their status. So, and we went on and added other types to the various people that we uncovered. But my point is to return to what you were asking about, the idea that there's a stereotypical picture of one kind of person using social media is completely and utterly, it seems to me, outdated and needs to change.
from my personal perspective, using Reddit and using there's a Facebook podcast discussion group about this podcast. And to your point, a lot of people on the Facebook page, very nice, haven't really gotten any mean comments about me or about the podcast. But then if you go to the Reddit page about this podcast, it's almost all negative comments about us and about the podcast and about what we've done, the work we've done in this case. And maybe it's because of the anonymity, the nature of Reddit or what, but.
There's actually some academic research into this idea of what anonymity kind of enables people to do. And it goes back to 2004. It was a piece of research that came up with the term toxic online disinhibition. So this is the idea that when you're online and when your identity is concealed, you're going to be much more vicious and nasty towards people than if you're, you know, in a forum where everybody knows who you are. So it is hiding behind that anonymity, I think, does enable, you know, the worst in some people to come out.
Both Elizabeth and I are on Twitter, and it's always interesting. We compare those people that will be mean to us on Twitter. And I think that, again, that online disinhibition effect, Elizabeth gets far more trolling than I do, because I think also there's a gender issue there as well, that people tend to be far meaner online to women than they would be to men. There's a sense in which they seem to target women in particular, as opposed to men. There does seem to be a sense in which, you know, I tend to get different types of stalking going online, as opposed to, rather, I usually get a cruel comment and then that will move away, that will move on. That doesn't necessarily happen all the time in terms of the gender split.
Another thing about your paper that stood out to me and was extremely interesting was the wound culture. Can you talk about that just for a little bit?
Well, it's this idea that we're so fascinated with murder and trauma and other kind of terrible things that happen in the world. And I think Mark Seltz is also, he's the person who came up with that idea of wound culture. And he's also described it as a theatre for the living and the murder leisure industry. And we are so fascinated with awful crimes. And it's interesting because it's completely disproportionate. If you look at the majority of police recorded crime, it's property crime, it's burglary, it's theft, it's things like that, it's drugs offences. And when you look at homicide, that's actually a very small proportion of all the crimes that happen. But we are, you know, utterly fascinated with it. There's that old saying, you know, by newspaper editors, if it bleeds, it leads. And I think that's still very much true for all types of media today.
And psychologically, we tend to call that co-activation, so that the person consuming this wound culture is both fearful of it, they're scared, because clearly there is a death, there's trauma as a consequence of what it is that they're consuming, because they're consuming somebody's life has been taken. But at the same time that there's fear about that, there's excitement, it's co-activation. They're excited in the same way. That kind of co-activation is easier to describe if you think about taking a ride on a Big Dipper, whereby you are screaming, but at the same time, you're rather enjoying the ride, the thrill of the ride, the speed of the ride. And so the wound culture taps into that sense whereby psychologically, we have both these dissonant fears, but happening at the same time, that there's that desperation to look away, but at the same time, not to look away.
The line that kind of gave me the chills a little bit was on the autopsy table, pornography and forensics meet and fuse. In a wound culture, the spectacle of a torn and open body is the relay point of private fantasy and public space. And that private fantasy and public space is, it just kind of sucked me in. It just, I read that, and everything about what we're doing with this podcast and everything about the people that contact us, it just, I mean, it that just defined it for me.
In this country, in England, Elizabeth and I are best known for our work in relation to serial murder. Now, clearly, we're in a different type of crime in relation to missing Maura Murray, but there is that incredible fascination with extreme violence and the potential for extreme violence, because ultimately what we're tapping into is a mystery, and people love a whodunit or a what happened, because of course mysteries are riven deep into the evolutionary psychology of human beings, because ultimately we have to unravel those mysteries as a way of surviving. And so I think there is something about engaging with this material which our ancestors would have engaged in different materials, but as a way of trying to make sense of the world that they were in, and without making it without going into too many kind of French philosophy, what we're dealing with here is that sense of, you know, how do we make sense of ourselves at this point in time?
Yeah, I very much agree with that. And I think when we're looking at stories like the Maura Murray disappearance, it's that sense of legend and that sense of folklore that's going on as well. So I think the appeal in her story in particular is that it carries a message or a belief or a lesson about, I think, yeah, in terms of young women's behaviour, what's expected of them, you know, when they begin to deviate from the mainstream and all of those types of things. So, you know, look what can happen if you bend the rules and you don't behave as expected. It's all of those types of things that have been appealing to people for centuries. And I think this is just one of the latest manifestations of that.
And therefore, yeah, there's that historic sense in which women who transgress are doubly deviant. Not only have they transgressed in terms of the law, and obviously the earlier podcast brought out the fact that Maura had been caught, we call it drunk driving, or I think you call it driving under the influence. She may have stolen something. She did steal something at West Point. So she was deviant in the sense that she had broken the law, and therefore she was doubly deviant because she had broken a stereotype about how women, what was appropriate for women to do and how they should behave.
That's great. I had a question from something that Liz had said, but you just answered it. So awesome.
Can I say, sure, one of the episodes that really intrigued me, because we're back to the sense of fascination and where are we now as a culture, and I regard North American culture and European culture, Northern European culture, as very similar. Where are we now? And there's this incredible fascination with psychopathy. And one of the episodes that really intrigued me was when you had interviewed Professor Robert Eckstein. And it seemed to me that that tapped into this sense of, was she a psychopath? And I find that really fascinating at the moment. You know, why do so many people believe that they can identify psychopathy? And for me, it goes back to one of my bugbears. One of the things my pet hates is the John Ronson book, The Psychopath Test, where so many people think they understand psychopathy and imply that that person is behaving because they've got psychopathic traits, and yet they do not understand that construct, that personality disorder at all. They have a really stereotypical view about what psychopathy is, almost in the same way that you were presenting, in terms of saying most people would think that somebody using Reddit would be doing so late at night, have long hair in a darkened room. That for me was one of the most interesting episodes, because I thought we were trying to really try and expand our understanding of what psychopathy actually was.
And I think it was the willingness, I think, of some people to label Maura as a psychopath, as a sociopath. It almost, we need an explanation for her behaviour. And I think we've found this when we've been trying to explain women's criminal or women's deviant behaviour for hundreds of years. We're very quick to point to kind of biological faults with them. rather than, you know, anything sociological or anything cultural. You know, they're damaged and they're wrong, and that explains it all. But we've moved on, I think, so much further than the kind of biological criminology, and some of the things that we look at now in terms of what we expect of women's behaviour, what we expect of men and different ethnicities and different age groups. I think it's getting much more sophisticated in terms of explaining why people behave in the way that they do. But I think in recent years, we've seen a bit of a pull back towards that biological determinism, which is what we call it, in terms of, well, psychopaths are born, they can't help it. They do these things because they're kind of hardwired and programmed. But we think that psychopathy, it's a combination of nature and nurture. So there will be people who are born with a tendency to be more aggressive, for example. But the extent to which that will come out and that how that will manifest itself is heavily dependent upon the type of family they grow up in, the type of community they grow up in, the type of values that surround them. So I found that psychopathy discussion really interesting because it does kind of pull us right back to those biological things.
Well, this conversation begs the question, what do you think? Do you think Maura was a sociopath? Or is there any way she was a psychopath?
Absolutely not. I think that she was clearly having some difficulties in the months preceding her disappearance, but to label her psychopathic as a consequence of those difficulties seemed to me to be missing the point entirely. I've worked all my adult career with violent psychopaths, and nothing that I've heard over the course of the podcast and in terms of any of the reading that I've done about Maura Murray would suggest that psychopathy was an issue for her.
What about any of the guests that we've had on the podcast or any of the people that we've mentioned?
Yes, I feel there were a number that one could think there were some difficulties, but I do know the laws of slander, and
we're trying to get you arrested.
It doesn't apply in America. It's fine.
Yeah.
I think this is what's so good about your podcast, though, is that you've been so open to all of these different voices, and it's given the audience a chance to listen to people. You've given people a platform, and they've had that platform and they've had their say, and then people are able to make up their own minds. You've not censored anybody or prevented anyone from being heard. I think you've opened it up as widely as possible, and I think that's only been to the benefit of your podcast.
Thank you. Yes, until we had to pull one of the episodes, I would agree.
Maybe we opened it up a bit too wide, so we closed it a little bit. The intentions are good. Some things you just can't control, and it just turns into doing more harm than good.
But there is a phenomenon going on there that that we Liz and I haven't been able to write about yet, but we will try and get around to at some stage, whereby every single day, I'm genuinely not exaggerating, I will get an email or a letter from a member of the public in this country who will claim to me that that a well-known paedophile called Robert Black, who's dead, had tried to abduct them when they were growing up. It's almost as if there's some meaning given to their life by claiming that this dreadful man who did abduct children, rape and kill them, had attempted to abduct them in their childhood. And it seems to me, therefore, there is this sense in which, and we're back to that idea of Seltzer's wound culture, that people are relating to this kind of trauma, that they want to be connected to this kind of trauma, because it's this kind of trauma and their relationship to it which makes them, but bizarrely, ironically, feel alive, feel special, feel different, feel connected, feeling part of our culture. And isn't that incredibly sad? But nonetheless, And Elizabeth is right. What the podcast has done, what you've allowed people to do, is to feel connected, even if some of them have been connected in ways which whereby you felt, my gosh, you just need help.
Wow. Yeah, no, that we totally meant to do all that.
Whatever you just said, totally meant it.
One part that I highlighted in your paper was your talk about secondary victims, and I found this very interesting. And here's a part. It is argued that the death of their relative becomes a media event. Secondary victims lose ownership over their loss. I thought that was really interesting, and it sort of made me sad. And I guess we must agree with that. Although I don't know if I really do in all cases, but I mean we did a podcast about this, so yeah, we took it away from the Murrays in a certain way. But yeah, I found the secondary victims losing ownership over this to be an interesting subject.
Yeah, and I think that's even more relevant today, now that we're in the age of new media and, you know, Facebook and Reddit and Twitter. And around the Heyman Lee case, we saw people setting up, the Woodlawn Scholarship Fund, and people kind of grieving these individuals that they never knew in life, but they kind of feel a connection to, because the information about their death is so readily available, and they're so kind of into these cases that they almost feel that they're a part of it. And I think that, you know, it's in one way, I think the secondary victims, the families and relatives of people, you know, who've been the victim of homicide, are sometimes, you know, quite pleased that their loved one is getting that attention, and that they're being, you know, validated in that way and recognized and remembered. But I think at the same time, it can be quite intrusive for people, because this was their friend, it was their relative, and now, yeah, everybody else is kind of, you know, wanting a piece of them.
Well, of course, ultimately, it's about control. And so, you when you engage either the old or the new media, you've got a tiger by the tail. And when you have a tiger by the tail, you can't control it. And so sometimes the secondary victimization is as a consequence of you feeling that you can't make the narrative go in a particular direction in which you would rather choose it to go in. I mean, Elizabeth and I have just supervised a PhD student called Harriet Tolpat, who looked at how the surviving family members of serial killers coped with the fact that they had a loved one killed by a high-profile British serial killer. And actually, what she uncovered, Harriet Tolpat uncovered, was that the families of the victims were desperate for media attention, were desperate to keep the story of their family member as high-profile as possible, because, again, it was like memorializing the fact that their daughter, their son, their husband, their wife was once a living human being and had importance in their lives. So it's back to that sense in which people will consume this kind of material in all kinds of different ways, but what can't be predicted is that they will be able to have control over that consumption. And it's that lack of control which leads to problems.
What you just described there is really close to the behavior that we've seen from the family, from the Murray family. It seems to me like they don't want to give up anything because they see where it could go, and that is a pretty dangerous place.
That's absolutely right. It's that sense in which getting an answer, they might get an answer, but not the answer they would like. And therefore, they cannot control an answer might emerge, which isn't the one they would have chosen when they first started the journey. And ultimately, therefore, that leads to people wanting to shut down. It leads to people to want to criticize or to scapegoat or to belittle, to demean. But it ultimately comes back to exactly the same point. Initially, you want the publicity because you think the publicity will memorialize and might lead to a conclusion which is helpful. But then when you get the publicity and you realize, well, wait a minute, I can't control what's actually happening here, you begin to shut down. You begin to think, there are consequences here which I don't like, and there are consequences here which I no longer feel that I can control.
And I think that's been even more amplified in newer media spaces. So when you look at some of the studies done of secondary victims and their interactions with more traditional media, often you find that there's somebody there helping them with that, whether that's a police officer or a family friend or somebody who knows the media. That's not so much there when we look at social media. So by kind of putting yourself out there on social media, there aren't any of those traditional barriers. So we know that the press in this country is regulated by a particular authority, as our television network. So there's a degree of protection when victims and secondary victims are engaging with the mainstream media, which just isn't there with social media. And they can put themselves in quite a vulnerable position by engaging with that type of media.
Yeah, and I think with the Murrays, it seems to me that they appreciate the attention that this podcast and other media outlets have given them. And they, I think they appreciate the comments like "Happy birthday, Maura," or "Really hope this is resolved one day." Comments like that on their Facebook page. I really do think that they deeply appreciate that. But in some way, they must relive it over and over, and it must take an emotional toll on them.
Yeah, because it's that balance, isn't it, between keeping a case in the spotlight and not kind of opening a can of worms and reopening old wounds again and again and again. But when you've got a case where it's a missing person and there isn't a definitive conclusion, I think there's always going to be that willingness to invite a few trusted people in who are going to help to publicize the case.
It's very sad, because ultimately, I sometimes feel, certainly some of the families of murder victims that I've spoken with, and I've spoken with countless now families of murder victims, there's a sense in which some of them will turn to the media as a form of therapy. And you do realize at that point that they become a lost soul, and you have to kind of help them realize that the media's agenda isn't as a therapist. The media's agenda isn't telling stories that are going to have purchase with an audience, and therefore their intentions, the media's intentions, are quite different from the intentions of the families who have engaged with the media. And so there's a delicate balance that has to be, there has to be an intervention often to say, look, actually, you've got to get help in some other way rather than continuing to tell your story. And don't imagine that you're going to be able to control how the story is told.
And that's got to be incredibly frustrating. I can see where it's incredibly sad for the relative of a murder victim, but I can't even imagine the frustration that it would have for somebody looking for their missing daughter or their missing sister, and knowing that they have to put themselves out there on some level, but not being able to grieve and not even having that to that therapeutic outlet, be it good or bad.
Some people that I've spoken to in that circumstance, though, have said, I'm dealing with this every single day by myself anyway. So the idea that some people might want to talk to me who've got similar experiences as a consequence of me talking about it in the media actually provides a form of relief. And And indeed, there is a sense, therefore, talking about one missing person draws attention to the phenomenon of people going missing. In this country, they're called MISPers. It draws attention to MISPers more generically. And the research that I was able to do in some of my earlier work draws attention to the fact that 66,000 young people go missing in England and Wales for at least one night every single year. Now, 66,000 might not seem very many in the context of how big the United States is, but when you only have something like 60 million people in England and Wales, that is a huge number of kids that are going to go missing. And thankfully, many of those people will turn up, many of those children will turn up unharmed, but all too often and all too sadly, many of them never turn up, or if they do turn up, they are turned up as somebody who has died as opposed to the living person who disappeared.
One question I wanted to ask is, do you think Lance and I have been sensitive or sensitive enough to the Murray family and their situation?
Well, I certainly think so. I think if I may observe, please forgive this kind of reflection. I don't know if you were expecting it, but I did think initially there was a kind of a negative tone towards the Murray family in the earlier podcasts. And I think actually, as the podcasts have gone on, there has been a much greater willingness to understand and put yourselves, walk in their shoes. And that has become much more apparent. And I think there was a Rubicon moment for you when you thought, actually, we've never really spoken to the Murrays. And when you did start to speak to the Murrays, then that allowed that difference in tone to emerge.
And I think it was... And partly the way that the media in general deal with the families of missing people and the families of people who are victims of crime, they can put their barriers up a bit and be a bit protective. So sometimes it's about finding that gatekeeper who will give you access to the family rather than, you know, approaching them directly. So it varies from one case to the next. But no, I think you've been incredibly sensitive in recent episodes, and having John Smith as that mediator, I think, has been a really important part of the process.
I think in terms of the international example, albeit it's a British example, but it's so well known, it's international now, about how families need the publicity and then worry about their inability to control the publicity is clearly the McCann case about Madeleine McCann, who goes missing and of course has still never been found. And of course the McCanns were very desperate for media attention just after their daughter had disappeared. And then gradually, as the days and weeks and months and now years have passed, they're having to sue police officers in Portugal, they're having to get injunctions taken out. Every single person in this country would have a view about the McCanns, and they just simply can't control that process. So there's that tiger by the tail analogy again, that you want the publicity, but ultimately you can't control where that publicity might take you. And I think for you guys, in relation to the Murrays, you've kind of recognized that, it seemed to me, or maybe I'm wrong, but I felt there was a recognition that you had to then think, well, wait a minute, there's a real family out there who are actually grieving and trying to make sense of what might have happened to this girl that was related to them. Why don't we ask them about how they're feeling and what they must be thinking about every single day that their daughter, their sister, their loved one hasn't been found?
I'm curious about the notion of the armchair detective. And you said the notion of the armchair detective is nothing new. Can you elaborate on that a bit?
Yeah, I think people have always had an opinion about particular crimes, particular mysteries, whether they be real or fictional. But I think in today's society, in terms of network media, the opportunity to voice that opinion and to connect with others who've got opinions has grown exponentially. So I think we've seen a real kind of acceleration of this type of thing. So, you know, back in the old days before the internet, you know, I'd be watching a crime drama at home with my mum and dad as a teenager, and we'd be speculating about who did it, or there'd be a story on the news about a murder, and, you know, there'd be a press conference on with the family, and my dad would go, oh, it's definitely him, he's definitely done it, it's that one there. And that was as far as it would go. But now we've got the opportunity to voice those opinions and speak to others and generate theories, you know, collectively. So I think it has taken on a whole new life, given the capacity of, and the affordances of network media.
And one of the oldest literary genres is, of course, the detective story. If we think about Wilkie Collins, Edgar Allan Poe, and if you think, obviously, which is common both to the UK and to the United States, the continuing interest in Conan Doyle and Sherlock Holmes. And so that sense in which we consume the detective story, the whodunit, as a way of giving ourselves pleasure, as a way of feeling smarter that we've worked out what's been going on before the denouement is presented in the final chapter. Now, of course, what's changed with new media is that consumption of the old-fashioned detective story was very private. You know, you consumed it and you read the book, you might have discussed the book after you had finished it, but effectively it was done privately. What new media is doing, what podcasts are doing, is allowing that consumption to be done in association, to be done communally, and therefore that communality allows for different ideas, different hypotheses to be worked through in a much more dynamic and immediate way than would ever be done in the way that the old media of the detective story used to be consumed.
Wow. I would love to take your class.
I would love to take your class and get an F.
You must ask Elizabeth. Elizabeth teaches in the master's program. Elizabeth teaches a new module all about new media and online crime. And she loves teaching about Maura Murray, the Maura Murray podcast, on that. You must ask her a question about that.
The module's called Crime Online, and our master's students take it in the second semester. And I always try and kind of make it much more interesting than the criminology textbooks, you know, make Crime Online, you know, out to be. So rather than just looking at things like hacking and phishing and identity theft, I look at those questions of new media and of remediation and all of those types of things. And that idea that we live our lives in media is a really important one to get to grips with. So I actually used the Maura Murray case and the Maura Murray podcast and the subreddit as a topic for one of our lectures. So people are really kind of understanding that continuity between the online and the offline and learning that crime and the internet as a topic is about much more than hacking and cracking and all of those types of things.
So what comes of the Maura Murray discussion from your classes? Do they, like our email inbox, like do they offer you their theories, or is it really just more focused on the result of what happens online with this case?
Well, what they tend to do, first of all, is just disappear off the radar for a while because they go and catch up on all the podcasts and, you know, don't emerge from their houses until they've listened to everything. But then they come back to uni with a real passion and an enthusiasm to talk about some of the issues that the podcast throws up. So it brings up some real kind of traditional criminological theory, you know, this idea of the theory of the missing white girl syndrome and all of this type of stuff and how we make sense of women's deviant and criminal behavior. But also they've got that new edge on it now in that they're looking at it through the eyes of criminology students who understand new media. So they've just got a real passion to find out more about it.
What is the missing white girl syndrome?
Well, this is the idea that essentially when we look at cases of missing people, that there are a particular group of cases that are going to get much more media attention than other cases. And this has been borne out by quite a lot of research as well. So when you have, especially when we look at children, so children who go missing, if they're white, if they're girls, if they've got blonde hair and blue eyes, then that makes them incredibly newsworthy. But if we look at children from disadvantaged backgrounds, who come from, you know, broken homes, whose parents are substance abusers and those types of things, those kids don't get anywhere near the amount of attention that the kind of worthier, you know, in inverted commas quote cases do. And this goes back to a criminological idea of the ideal victim. So this was announced by a criminologist back in the 1980s called Nils Christie. And he said the ideal victim is somebody who, when hit by crime, is most readily accorded the status of the victim because they're seen as vulnerable, as worthy of our sympathy, because they're completely innocent. They're not to blame at all for being victims, for finding themselves as victims. And we found this in this country, the case of Steve Wright, who murdered several sex workers in Ipswich a few years ago. There were all of the discussion around them was describing them as sex workers, you know, and they weren't seen, you know, as mothers, as sisters, as people with, you know, ambitions and those types of things. So I think the mainstream media has got, you know, this idea of what's newsworthy, you know, what victims are going to be appealing to our audiences, what victims do people really not care less about.
And therefore, the kinds of people who will go missing, who won't appear in podcasts, who won't appear on the front pages of regional, local, or indeed national papers, will be men and will be black men, and working class black men in particular. So this idea of there being an ideal victim that news editors will prioritize in terms of the kinds of stories that they will pick. I was suggesting earlier to you that 66,000 young people in England and Wales will go missing each particular year in this country. But news editors will choose one of those 66,000 young people that go missing to make a story out of. And the story and that one person or a handful of people will be tend to be, as Elizabeth said, idealized white children who are girls who have blonde hair and blue eyes. And so the missing white woman syndrome that we've been talking about fits entirely in terms of the publicity that's given to Maura Murray, but not given to some of the black girls of a similar age who have been missing for the same length of time and who went missing at the same time as Maura Murray.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I'm sure that's absolutely true in media. Certainly wasn't the reason we got involved in this case, but maybe it certainly contributes to the reason that it is so popular.
I was actually just going to say, we're saying it's not the reason we got involved in this case, but the reason I got involved in this case was because her picture popped up while I was looking for, you know, just it was fulfilling my true crime
her and picture. Therefore, there was a limited number of pictures that could have popped up because there would only be a limited number of pictures that news editors felt were going to create what's called proximity between that news story and those people, those audiences that that news story was aimed at. And increasingly, those pictures would be of white girls as opposed to black girls. They'd be of girls as opposed to boys. They'd be of middle class people as opposed to working class people. They would be of people who came from established or traditional family backgrounds as opposed to people who came from much more fluid family backgrounds.
Yeah, and pretty rapidly, once you get into the case, you realize all of the all the oddities and all the eccentric things that surround the case and the characters in the case and, you know, the area in New Hampshire where she disappeared. So that takes over at very quickly. That takes over. But just getting involved in it, yeah, it is that picture of the young white woman that's right there. And then once you start reading about it, that's what starts your interest.
Just one thing that you just said about the area there just got me thinking about another area of criminology that's become quite interesting in recent years is this idea of dark tourism. So people wanting to go to places where people have disappeared from, where people have been murdered, where, you know, horrendous crimes have happened. There is a kind of real little leisure industry that's developing around particular cases, especially in relation to serial killers and that type of thing. And I'd be interested to hear your views about some of the residents up there in New Hampshire in terms of, you know, how they feel. Have they noticed an increase in the number of people visiting the site, knocking on their doors and that kind of thing, really?
Oh, yeah, they hate it. The people up there near the accident site where Maura disappeared, the Westmans and some other people, well, really, maybe I'm speaking more of the Westmans more than anyone because I don't know if I can directly speak about anyone else, but they really don't appreciate it at all.
Well, the owners of the Swiftwater Stage Shop as well. Uh-huh. You really shouldn't go in there and ask about, you know, hey, I'm looking into the Maura Murray case.
Right. You'll get chased out with a bat.
Bridges have been burned up there.
Yeah.
Well, Elizabeth mentioned the Ipswich case in her previous answer. And I was working on the Ipswich case. This was a case in 2006 in Suffolk in England when a number of young women were murdered by somebody called Steve Wright, and those women were sex workers. And I remember I was standing beside the police do not cross tape, and I saw a bus arrive, and I thought it was and people got off the it was a minibus, and people got out of the minibus, and I thought it must be the family of the girl whose body had just been found. And I thought I should go up and introduce myself because, you know, I'd clearly been involved in trying to work out what was happening. And as I went up and I put out my hand to shake it to the first person that got off the bus, the man waved my hand away and said, "Oh, don't worry about me. We saw it on the news and we just wanted to come down and look for ourselves." And that took me completely back into seltzer and wound culture and feeling that they needed to become connected to sites of trauma. And that dark tourism is another area that seems to me that criminology hasn't yet grasped and hasn't yet wanted to talk about.
That's really interesting. As you're saying that, I thought back to the first time I was in Los Angeles and I took one of those star tours. I don't know why, but the only two things I remember from it right now is driving by Jack Nicholson's house and driving by the O.J. Simpson house. And everyone was fascinated by that. And I think there's still tours that go around that area, even though the house doesn't exist anymore.
And I wonder how many of the people listening to the podcast have gone on the San Quentin tour, you know, visiting prisons. You know, why do we want to turn prisons into experiences where tourists will buy to be shown round the jail by an ex-inmate. It's a very strange phenomenon that we're beginning to identify these sites of trauma as places that we will consume and enjoy in other ways.
As both of you experience the case, the Moore Murray case, as you listen to the podcast and read all the material, have either of you thought to yourself that this is something, from a criminologist's standpoint, this is something that is solvable?
Well, I think,
yes.
these cases are always solvable, because it's like we say, somebody always knows something, and the way that a lot of cold cases actually get solved is often not through DNA, not through forensic evidence, but through people's loyalties changing and people's relationships changing, and people who were protecting somebody at a particular point in time, that relationship may have changed 10 years later, 15 years later. So I think the key is always people and their relationships, you know, rather than anything else. And that can take quite a long time to unravel and for things to come loose.
Liz, you said something about, after a period of time, someone knows something, relationships might deteriorate, and somebody is more willing to talk. And that stood out to me, because I know that people like John Smith and other investigators who have been with the family and have been investigating the case since the beginning have moments of extreme frustration, because it affects their lives, it affects their jobs, it ultimately affects everything going on around them, and they feel like after 12 years they've gotten nowhere. And when you said that, it almost sounded like a moment of optimism, where maybe this is a good time to keep pushing a little bit harder to talk to people, because maybe those relationships are starting to deteriorate and maybe some people want to talk.
Yeah, I think when a case is, you know, as John Smith is always saying, brought back into the light, people can't, you know, be in denial for very much longer. Because I think when a case doesn't get very much coverage, it becomes forgotten about, it becomes swept under the carpet, it's much easier for people who do know something about it to get on with their lives and not say anything. But when people are being constantly reminded of it, you know, because it's in the media again, because it's high profile, I think maybe that is the point at which something can be shaken loose in cases like these. And there's cases that we have of missing people in the UK, where you see appeals, you know, 10 years after, 15 years after, and actually it's at that point when something does come away and the can of worms is opened up.
That's a very clever answer that Elizabeth has given, and it's based on both our theoretical work and our applied work. But I wonder, were you hinting at in your question, do we have a view about what might have happened to Maura Murray?
That was my next question.
And I think you're giving me too much credit.
Do you, David and Liz, have a theory on what happened to Maura? You know, coming from your very interesting criminologist background.
Wow. I think all of the options are still on the table, because we haven't been able to definitively exclude, you know, one or another, you know, theory. So I think, and the fact that it is an ongoing investigation as well, and I've listened to the most recent podcast, and the amount of information that law enforcement is willing to give out is always quite limited and quite, you know, well screened. So if you haven't got access to all of that information, then you're going to be incredibly constrained in where you come down in any particular camp.
I tend to be the more Presbyterian between Elizabeth and myself, and I tend to therefore always, I think she's dead. I think if she was still alive, we would have found some evidence of her living, whether that be living under an assumed identity or otherwise. So my own sense is that she's dead. Whether she was abducted or took her own life, I veer towards taking her own life. I've worked on cases where somebody could be abducted very, very quickly, And that abduction, pops out of the blue. So I'm aware that abduction can happen on the spur of the moment, by chance, unbelievably so. But I don't get the sense that she was abducted at all. I think that her life was unraveling in very extreme ways, very quickly. And I think she intended to take her own life. And one of the things that's always confused me is that I never understood from the podcasts or from things I've then subsequently read, is the investigation into trying to find her after the car had crashed. And I know that when you and I, Lance, Tim, made email contact, you both pointed out to me that there were no footprints, but I in the close vicinity that police were able to track. But I would presume that she found some way and died. Again, when people say to me, well, then surely her body would have been found by now. Again, I've worked on cases whereby bodies often get lost. We are a very small piece of humanity in a very large world, and often bodies are not found for year after year after year.